From the hills of central New York in the heart of the Finger Lakes, this is Frankly Speaking, and I'm your host, Frank Rossi. This is our first episode of our 11th season here at Frankly Speaking, and I wanted to take a moment to shout out to our regular listeners. You are the reason we exist. To our sponsors who pay the bills and allow us to provide high production quality, and to the staff and community at TurfNet, we are nowhere without our turfgrass community. My guest on this episode of Frankly Speaking is Dr. Ross Braun, Assistant Professor of Turfgrass and Landscape Management at Kansas State University and the Director of the Rocky Ford Turfgrass Research Center. Ross has a bachelor's degree from North Dakota State University and an MS and PhD from Kansas State University. Additionally, he had a stint at Purdue University as a research scholar. For a relatively newly minted doctoral degree, Ross has an impressive array of research publications, as well as his blog posts for the Tri-Society's Decode 6, Decoding Carbon and Ecosystem Services. Before we get to our conversation with Dr. Ross Braun, let me remind you of the great value and commitment to service you get from our partners at the Plant Food Company. I'm entering my 23rd year of working with professionals such as global sales lead Tom Weiner, who was the first to capture my attention with nutrient products to meet the needs of the modern superintendents with research to back it. Check out the products and pros at the Plant Food Company at plantfoodco.com. Dr. Ross Braun, welcome to Frankly Speaking. For a fairly newly minted PhD, you have been enormously productive. So let me just start with saying thanks for an industry that hasn't recognized it yet. A lot of us do stuff that people don't notice for another 10 or 15 years, and they'll probably dig this podcast up someday and listen back to it when you're receiving some Distinguished Service Award. Because, Ross, this work has been really both wide-ranging and also with a sufficient amount of depth in particular areas, too. Now, we're going to get to that. Let's start out. Are you from North Dakota? And if you are, how did you get interested in turf stuff up there? So let's talk about your early years and getting your way to North Dakota State.
Yeah, Frank, it's great to be here. I'm super excited. So a little background about myself. Yeah, I'm born and raised in North Central North Dakota, way up there near the Canadian border almost, and had my own lawn care business throughout high school. And that started to fuel my passion for turfgrass. I also avid golfer. I've been golfing since I could walk. Combining those two together, I realized there was a turfgrass management program at North Dakota State University. And so I went to North Dakota State for my undergrad. While I was completing my undergraduate bachelor's, I interned at a few different golf courses around the country, out in Wyoming and Minneapolis, Minnesota, and worked at a course back in Fargo while I was in school and got the golf course management side of things. And I enjoyed it. At the same time, I wanted to continue on with my education and go to grad school. And it worked out. There was a position at Kansas State University, having Dr. Jack Fry as my advisor there for my master's. And I studied turfgrass colorants, looking at, you know, providing winter green color and for dormant warm season grasses like zoysia grass and buffalo grass, and and did some large patch research as well with zoysia grass.
Yeah. Well, let's take a minute there.
Yeah. Okay.
Because we got time, and I'm really fascinated by the work you do, not just the breadth of it and the way you do it, but the work you do in particular. So for your master's, right, you did these things, strategies to improve zoysia grass performance is how your master's is listed, right? And so pigments and paints wound up being a significant part of that, right? Because zoysia grass doesn't maintain its color very well. Did you find anything that did help the zoysia grass go deeper into the season? Or did you really have to go to the sort of indurient ambient pigments and paints?
Yeah, so zoysia grass, it kind of has that golden brown color. And just like Bermuda grass and buffalo have their kind of distinct dormant brown colors as well. And when we first started looking at, you know, what if we overseed zoysia grass? And it's just got such a dense canopy. It's really difficult to overseed as well as what a lot of people probably do with Bermuda grass down in the southern United States, right?
Like the blue muta, where you maybe have a partner grass.
Right, yeah. And so we looked into using turf colorants. And now this was over 12, 13 years ago. So there wasn't that many products on the market at that time. And there's been quite a few more since. And so we started looking at, okay, well, what application rate should we be going out at? And when should we be applying these turf colorants? And what we kind of found through all that is there's multiple products that work. They each kind of have their distinct color. So you maybe have to shop around and kind of find what you're looking for as far as is it a dark green? Is it a light green, more of a blue green? But then also we found that going out at a higher application rate with a higher spray carrier volume, you can potentially make that colorant last a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. But what also helps is timing, a potential second timing about midwinter, late December, early January, to get that colorant to last throughout the winter time. And that was done here in Kansas. So we have, you know, our zoysia grass is dormant pretty much from late October all the way up until early April. So
honestly, Ross, not any different than it is for us. Now, was this golf turf that was going to be receiving traffic, or was it just to keep zoysia grass lawns green?
Well, we did a little bit of both. We did some lawn height stuff, and then we also did some golf course fairway height around half inch, three quarter of an inch zoysia grass as well. And some of that was done on a golf course, our university course here in Manhattan, Kansas at Covert Hills. And it did receive traffic. And obviously, the more traffic it receives, it's going to wear away that turf colorant.
Okay. All right. So now you do this really cool work with zoysia grass. And then it looks like you stuck around Kansas State. And I don't know specifically, but it looks like by topic wise, you started working with my old pal and former podcast guest, Dale Bremmer.
Yeah. So it was one of those things where as I was finishing up my master's, I started realizing, yeah, I want to continue on and for my PhD and maybe go into academia or industry. And just so happened that Dr. Dale Bremmer had some funding come in from the United States Golf Association looking at greenhouse gas emissions, specifically nitrous oxide emission and also carbon sequestration. That's pulling carbon dioxide out of the air. So that worked out where I could start that research as I was pretty much defending my master's that same summer, and kind of did a complete change on topics and stopped dealing with the turf colorants and headed in a different direction.
And it sounds like, well, certainly we're going to get to this later in our conversation, but you've returned to that interest after some sidetracking over at Purdue. So you finish your degree and then join the team at Purdue. I got to say, that's a really solid team at Purdue. The addition of Lee Miller didn't hurt it any, but they got a good group of people there, and that looked like a place to thrive. I know Cal is, you know, such a giving instructor and researcher, and Aaron Patton is the consummate pro. I mean, if you looked up extension specialist in the dictionary, you'd see Aaron Patton's picture next to it. He's that much of a defining figure. That was a smart move. Why?
Yeah, so
not that I don't think you're smart or anything, Ross, but no, that you know, there was probably some faculty jobs maybe too, or industry jobs.
There was. I was interviewing for one and looking around at a faculty position. At the same time, Dr. Aaron Patton at Purdue reached out and contacted me that he was looking for a postdoctoral researcher. And just knowing his history and track record, I was like, oh man, I can't pass up this opportunity to go work for him and potentially have him as my mentor. Mm-hmm. And probably one of the best decisions I've ever made. So went to Purdue for a little over 4 years working with Aaron, and we did all sorts of things. So
you did. So that's the interesting thing. Let's talk about this for a second, because you know, you're a young guy still, and there's probably a lot of guys listening to this or who are assistants or even superintendents and you know, had not thought about sort of a pathway that you took, you know, the study of it rather than the practice of it to a certain extent, right, is what we do on our side of the business. This has been a rewarding journey for you servicing those people, but I wonder what you'd say to some folks out there that might be like, yeah, but I could never do that research. There's no role for me there. I don't want to do sales. I'm not sure about golf. How would someone like that, maybe not with a graduate degree yet, start thinking about this? Maybe this is a hype little for your, do you have a job open out at the Rocky Ford Center? Or is there, you know, how can other folks sort of take a path you took, maybe not going all the way to the PhD, but taking some time to really learn under someone about research and study this turf grass area?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always looking for grad students, so, but for grad school, you don't have to, it's not like a big commitment to say, oh, I'm going to go all the way out on my PhD. When I started grad school, it was, I'm just going to go on for my master's and then I'll see what lies ahead once I get close to finishing that. And getting that master's really helped open my eyes to the whole science side of the industry and all this research that's being done at all these different land grant universities to benefit the industry. And it's the same with sales, and we're all connected. Yeah. And so I oversee all the undergraduate program here at K-State. And I tell my students, you know, even just job shadowing someone for a day or so is super beneficial to see what their day-to-day looks like. And, you know, not every day is the same, but the interns that they're doing and other land grant universities universities that have turf grass programs have these internships. So it's nothing, you know, new that we're doing here at K-State. But, oh man, the experience that my students come back with doing internships and getting out of state or in state is just so beneficial to their career. So
yeah, and I second that. And let me just ask a specific question about one of your mentors and someone that I've interviewed a couple of times on this show, Dale Bremmer. What was it like to be around someone that, in my opinion, sort of is a member of the turf grass industry, but at the same time has this skill set that is unique in our research community in some ways, or has been in the past unique? What was it like working with a guy like Dale who sort of looked at turf a little bit differently than maybe Jack did, as a more sort of cultural management, fertilizer, grass type golfer kind of guy?
Right. Yeah. So Dale's a big mentor in my life as well. And just getting that experience working for him and kind of seeing it from an outside perspective. You know, Dale didn't have a extensive background in turf grass. You say that Dr. Jack Fry did, like you mentioned. A lot of my PhD research focused on some of what we call it basic research, looking at maybe it's not so applicable down the road, but try to get some more understanding on some of these topics. And then potentially we can carry some of that over and make it applied research, but definitely helped me see things from different perspectives. And I'm a big advocate of the turf grass industry, but when I teach my intro to turf grass course here at K-State, we got to look at what we're doing and what potential impacts we're having on our environment, right? So are we having positive impacts or negative impacts? So
how does that message go over with your students?
I think it goes over quite well. I don't get really any rebuttal from that, but I'm trying to set that kind of seed early to get them thinking, don't just do what the previous person did at the course, or this is the way you heard it, but really think of the science behind it and, you know, trust the science. Like, there's really great turf grass research being done at all these different land grant universities, and we're doing it to help the industry, to better the industry. There's no hidden agenda or anything like that. And so even, you know, like my PhD research dealt with greenhouse gases and climate change gets thrown in there. And I'm not going to try to persuade anybody to think one way or the other. They can come to their conclusions on their own, but we're trying to learn more and we're trying to teach more on this and just expand our knowledge. And so we're not coming about it with any sort of hidden agenda. I'm trying to benefit the stakeholders, the golf course superintendents.
And I think that's an excellent way of summarizing your sort of philosophical view of the way you approach your work. Now, if you take your work apart, right, and you go back to even your work with Dale, where you were simulating traffic on, you know, dry grass, there's still a lot of stuff that you would say, we've got to learn about some basic aspects of how turf performs. Your most recent paper about different fertilizer and pesticide uses on cool season turf grass species, there's not a lot of that work out there yet. And so, yes. So when you're teaching the class, you're also, I'm sure, saying, boy, we've got a lot to learn here.
Definitely. When I was at Purdue University, just carrying over that kind of environmental stewardship mindset. Mm-hmm. For example, we did a lot of research with fine fescues. Right. And, you know, for fine fescues, a cool season grass, it's kind of, for the longest time, it's kind of been marketed or talked about as a low input grass and similar how like zoysia grass is and buffalo grass for warm season grasses. But there's not a lot of data or research backing up these claims.
That's right.
And so that led us to do some research at Purdue University to say, okay, can we actually put some numbers to this? Can we show if fine fescues, the different fine fescues, do they require less fertilizer? Do they require less pesticide inputs, or do they require less mowing inputs compared to other cool season grasses when we're managing them all side by side under the same environment? And so that's some of the research we did at Purdue. I'm carrying some of that over at K-State here and still working and collaborating with Dr. Aaron Patton at Purdue. And we're doing it now with warm season grasses, with zoysia grass and Bermuda grass and buffalo, because again, zoysia grass and buffalo grass for the longest time, we in the industry say, oh, those are low input. They require less mowing and require less fertilizer. And anecdotally, we've seen that. But again, we need to put some numbers to that so we can actually quantify that. So
I'm Frank Rossi. I'm chatting with Dr. Ross Braun at K-State University. This is Frankly Speaking. When we come back, we're going to take apart that fescue zoysia grass research because there's been a lot of it going on. We'll be right back after this message. I started working with Ken Ross and the professionals at Frost Spray Technologies in 2018 with some GPS-guided spray technology, and now we're integrating the Frost application system with the Greenkeeper app, and I gotta tell you, it's a no-brainer. Get control of your GPS sprayer with Frost Spray Technologies and get the most out of it with your Greenkeeper app. Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm with Dr. Ross Braun from Kansas State University. And Ross, right when we left, you set us up perfect. What are the numbers saying that if you start to plant, let's start with your cool season work with the guys at Purdue, but of course it's all including a lot of people that are fussing around with the fescues as well. What are some of the numbers saying that you're finding across a number of different studies that you've done? What types of fine fescues? Let's start there. Did you learn anything that you would tell people about the various subspecies or festucas and the way we think about them in generalities? Like, you know, creeping reds do better with fertilizer, chewings do better. Less with let's do that first. Let's start with the fine fescue species differentiation from your perspective.
Yeah, great. One of the first things we did is we did a very extensive literature review on the fine fescues. Let's just see what has been done and combine and catalog that all together. And so when we talk about the fine fescues, when I'm teaching about fine fescues, it's just this grouping, this terminology is there's no actual turf grass that's called fine fescue. It's just a grouping terminology that we give five different turf grass species, and some of them are subspecies. And these are strong creeping red fescue, slender creeping red fescue, and chewings fescue. Those are all three subspecies of red fescue. And then we have two others that are related to one another, and those are sheep fescue and hard fescue. And so these five different, for lack of a better name, fine fescues, we group them together in this terminology because they look very similar, thin, narrow leaf blade, almost like a pine needle-like leaf blade. So if you're standing out in the field and you're looking at these, it's actually pretty difficult to start to differentiate and visually differentiate these from one another. However, there are performance differences and differences in their stress tolerances. And we started to see some of that looking at all the literature. And there's also growth habit differences. So like the strong creeping red and the slender creeping red fescue, those produce rhizomes, whereas the other three are bunch type growth habits. And so we did some sod research at Purdue, and we've collaborated with University of Minnesota. And we found that, hey, strong creeping red fescue, especially newer cultivars that have been released in the last 10 years, they actually produce pretty good sod strength, similar to Kentucky bluegrass. But the others, like chewings fescue and hard fescue with the bunch type growth habit, do not. And so that's just one example. And that's actually one of the disadvantages of grouping them all together as fine fescues is if you were to go and cut some sod on your golf course to move it to another area and it just falls apart, you're like, well, fine fescue doesn't hold together at all. But we'll hold up, strong creeping red does. And if you mix that in with other fine fescues, it does pretty well holding things together. So there's advantages and disadvantages of grouping them all together in this kind of fine fescue grouping. And so at Purdue, we did numerous studies on sod research, on quantifying the inputs, and we compared it to other, you know, traditional cool season grasses like Kentucky bluegrass and perennial ryegrass and tall fescue, again, to see if these fine fescues, these individual species as well, if they do require less inputs of, say, mowing or fertilizer or pesticides. And we found that typically newer fine fescue cultivars require both anywhere from 40 to 55% fewer fertilizer and pesticide inputs compared to Kentucky bluegrass and perennial ryegrass and tall fescue. And we found also we compared against some new cultivars of fine fescues to some of the older cultivars. And again, that's even going to also help in turn save on fertilizer and pesticide inputs. So if we're planting new and improved cultivars that have come out of these breeding programs throughout the United States, that's another way we can reduce inputs. Right. But even the older fine fescue cultivars help save fertilizer and pesticide inputs compared to growing, say, Kentucky bluegrass or perennial ryegrass.
What if we start to embrace doing less, like what we're doing in unirrigated areas in like your climate and our climate, where they might have fescues out in the far rough, where they're not irrigated, maybe mowed only once or twice a year? Are those more harsh conditions, in your mind, better suited to the hard and the sheep's fescues versus the chewings and the reds? Or does the variability within the types exceed the variability among the types?
If it's for these kind of natural, native golf course rough areas, whatever you want to call them, minimal to no mow areas, you know, they go by many different names. I then strongly recommend incorporating in some hard or sheep fescue into that mixture. It's been shown they have better drought tolerance and a little bit better heat tolerance as well. So like, you know, here in Kansas, we being in the transition zone, I'm not recommending anybody go out and, you know, plant fine fescue in a full sun area in their front lawn. But if you're putting in some of these natural rough areas, do some sort of mixture with fine fescues. And if you're going to definitely incorporate hard fescue, we actually see in Kansas that the hard and the sheet fescues and chewings do better than the strong and the creeping red here for our climate. And with that, we've seen really depending on where you're at in the country, some of these fine fescues do better than others. And it's just differences in climatic differences with humidity and moisture and all that. You know, for example, up in Minnesota, I think they typically see the hard fescues do a little bit better up there and the chewings fescues, where when I was in Indiana, it was the strong creeping red and the slender creeping red do a little bit better. So you got to do a little bit of your homework and kind of figure out which ones perform better. Maybe you want to include a little bit of more of those in the mixture, maybe than the other ones.
Okay. So there's a couple of uses that I think about: bunker banks on golf courses, right? And of course, expansive roughs, right? With the amount of rough areas on most northern golf courses, right? If you're talking about 40 to 55% reductions in mowing, fertilization, potentially water, you'd start to put in long expanses of these things on the golf course. And one of the knocks has been traffic tolerance.
Yep.
Now, that said, and I think I talked to Eric about this, but, you know, at my advanced age, Russ, I'm not remembering as well, so I'm going to ask you. I remember Stacy Bonos, Dr. Bonos at Rutgers University, who's also worked with the fescues a lot in her breeding program as well. I've heard her say, you know, they're more traffic tolerant than you thought. And in fact, when you manage them like X, they can be even more traffic tolerant than when you manage them like Y. Can you speak at all about the potential for their use, even where there's significant traffic, or is it really a no-go?
No, it's definitely a go. The biggest thing with the traffic tolerance is if they're stressed out and they got some drought stress going on, or if it's really hot, yeah, you probably want to manage that traffic and definitely keep the carts off or the maintenance equipment off. Because, and I've seen this in Indiana, if they were under some sort of drought stress, and even like a push lawnmower, it left tracks. But if it's adequate soil moisture and it's not too stressed out, it does pretty well. So when I talk about managing these fine fescues, if it's more of a native rough area or the, you know, the bunker surrounds and stuff that you're going to let them grow up a little bit, you know, these fine fescues, a little goes a long way. And we got to be careful that we don't over manage these grasses. That's a common problem, is maybe they're getting hit by the irrigation. We need to adjust our irrigation heads a little bit because you want to maybe keep them on the dry side.
Okay, so let's explore some of this work. You've just done so much there. Let's take on using it in companionship with clover. There seems to be growing interest in these integrated stands, if not for lawns, maybe lower input, you know, mom and pop golf courses. Maybe they don't mind clover. One of the issues with clover, when it gets a little tall, right, you can lose your ball in it. And my experience is it generally doesn't play nice, Ross. Once it gets going, it sort of crowds out everything else. What did you find relative to how the fine fescues did with something like a companion species like clover?
Yeah, so we did some research while I was at Purdue working in collaboration with University of Minnesota and Oregon State University. And we looked at, okay, who we potentially include clover in with these different fine fescues. And we looked at individual fine fescue species, if there's any sort of interaction there with the clover. Overall, we actually saw that the clover, obviously, it's going to reduce some turf cover. We're going to have more clover than turf at times. And it actually slows down the establishment just a little bit. We also looked at, does it impact the overall sod strength of the turf, and including clover, if a sod grower was trying to grow some sort of B-lawn mixture to sell, the clover is actually going to weaken that sod strength. So if we're going to include clover and turf, we got to make sure that our expectations are going to line up with, you know, we're not going to get our perfect looking turf with clover. That's what happens a lot of times, is our expectations don't actually line up with what is reality there. So,
yeah. All right, a couple more things about the fescues. Let's talk about sod production and what you've learned there, because a lot of the things that you have to do to produce a sod, Ross, are counter to really good fescue establishment and success. Accelerating it with nitrogen and water, maybe seeding at a higher rate, or maybe even putting some bluegrass in there to hold it together, right? Maybe the underground structures aren't enough to tie it all together. Talk a little bit about sort of adaptation sod growers have to make, because I got to tell you, golf course superintendents buy a lot of fine fescue sod. Talk us through what a sod grower, maybe best practices as you describe them.
So yeah, when we did the sod research at Purdue University, we definitely wanted to compare and figure out, okay, which of these fine fescues can produce good sod? Maybe none of them can. And we wanted to compare them with Kentucky bluegrass, the best and most traditional, obviously, cool season sod growing, right? So we looked at different things like seeding rates, increasing fertilizer levels up until harvest, and we harvested at different timings at, you know, anywhere from 11 months all the way up to 24 months after planting at different timing intervals. We also included tall fescue. And really what we saw is that strong creeping red fescue, because it's producing rhizomes, just like Kentucky bluegrass produces rhizomes, is it produces a really good sod strength and sod handling. It holds together really well and at times better than Kentucky bluegrass, especially early on, because we know that Kentucky bluegrass, it's got that slower germination and establishment. For the fine fescues are pretty good. They're similar to tall fescue. Obviously, they're not as fast as perennial ryegrass, but they establish pretty good, a lot faster than Kentucky bluegrass. And say a normal sod grower is going to apply anywhere from 3 to 4 pounds of nitrogen per year up until harvest. We don't need that much with the fine fescues. And actually, it's not beneficial to be applying that much. So you can actually reduce that amount by almost 2 to 3 times. And just even 1 to 2 pounds of nitrogen fertilizer for the strong creeping red fescue is going to produce a really good sod strength. And then we also looked at mixtures, mixing with other cool season grasses. And the main take home point there was, if you're going to look at some sort of cool season mixture with, say, the fine fescues, or mixing the fine fescues with Kentucky bluegrass, you just want to have at least 33% or more of the mixture be strong creeping red fescue because of that knitting it does with the rhizomes. Nice. And that's going to really increase sod strength.
Nice. Love that. That's really good that you could give a solid recommendation. And I got to tell you, when you look at the work you guys have done, the work Eric's been doing, of course, work at Rutgers, it's really gotten popular. But at the same time, there seems to be a lot of barriers to guys using them. And it looks like you were involved in the study of that as well. What are some of the hurdles? I mean, Maggie Ryder and I have chatted about this many times in our many different working capacities over the last several years, because she, you know, used to sit right next to Eric in Minnesota. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are, how we help get this species planted in more places and not just pigeonholed as low input, but also something that can be used as a sod and provide lots of benefits.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest barriers is, again, by grouping all these five different species together and calling them fine fescues just for the ease. We then don't really actually realize that, hey, there's differences in their growth habit, which in turn affects sod strength, or there's differences in their different stress tolerances. Some are more disease resistant to snow mold. Some are more disease resistant to red thread. And some have a better close mowing tolerance, so they perform better at fairway heights. So there's all these little different characteristics of these five different species that we lose when we start to group them all together and think they all perform the same and act the same under the same environment. But really, they start to separate themselves out. So we got to, as a golf course superintendent, a sod grower, homeowner, whatever it may be, you got to do a little bit more homework and realize, oh, this one might work a little bit better for this situation. I maybe need to include a little bit more of that in the mixture than some of the other ones. And so that's one of the biggest things, is by us grouping them together, we're kind of hurting ourselves.
So people don't think about them in the broad sense that they need to. Now, listen, I'll get you out of here on this, because you've looked at a lot of fine fescue stands and you probably looked at some young to middle-aged stands. When I look at older stands, and I've chatted with Tom Cook at Oregon State many years ago, and he used to show me how thatchy the fine fescues can get. And I just think that sort of happens over time too, right? As they get older, they've got a lot of that ligniceous material at the base of the plant that just, it's recalcitrant, right? The organisms don't break it down rapidly. It accumulates. Is that climate specific, or is that potentially something we're going to have to learn to live with or address at some point in some of these older stands? Or maybe you didn't see it very much.
You know, I didn't see that much, but I know what you're talking about. And I don't think it's climate specific. I think that's going to occur. And that's going to occur even, say, like in a tall fescue system as well, in a tall fescue rough or a lawn or something like that. And so, again, these fine fescues, it's not plant it and completely forget it. You got to give it something, right? And so it's going to need some cultural practices as well every once in a while, maybe to reduce some thatch. And get in there with aerified or whatever, and even fertilizing it, like 1 to 2 pounds, apply most of that in the fall, you'll be good. But don't start applying more than 2 pounds like it's a Kentucky bluegrass.
All right, listen, Ross, we'll take another break. And when we come back, we're going to get back to your emissions work and the Decode 6 blog, which I've really enjoyed and so glad to see you contributing from the turf side. I'm with Dr. Ross Braun. This is Frank Rossi. We'll be right back. Nothing works on your putting surfaces if your soils don't function properly. They have to drain well, resist compaction, and maintain acceptable amounts of organic matter. Invariably, soils will get layered, compaction will influence turf performance, and drainage will slow. DryJect Services have the tools to address all of these physical property issues in one pass. Learn more about DryJect Services at dryject.com. Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. Ross Braun and I are about to chat about strategies for reducing inputs and emissions in turf grass systems, what I believe to be one of the single most important papers that I've seen published in the last 10, 15 years. Honestly, I am so thrilled you guys got together and just codified this thing and said, listen, the BMP should be focused on these things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Not just soil testing for soil testing's sake, right? But working actively, assertively, intentionally to reduce something. Have the focus be good playing conditions or nice looking lawns or traffic tolerant safe fields, and not or, and protect and preserve environmental quality, right? I mean, this is fundamentally what you've codified now. How did this come about? It seems like a return to what you then worked on with Dale at one point. How did this paper come about, and how has the interest been since you've published it?
Yeah, so I was approached by the American Society of Agronomy, Crop Science Society of America, that produce a lot of our scientific articles, like in Crop Science and Crop Forage and Turf Management, Agronomy Journal, you name it. And they were putting out a special issue on climate change, looking at different fields of agronomy and so on. And I was like, well, yeah, I'd love to write one on turf grass. And perfect. It could be on really anything, but somehow tie it in to how can we mitigate some of the effects and our potential of climate change. And so kind of assembled this team with Dr. Aaron Patton again, Dr. Yeah. Chase Straw, Dr. Soldat, Dr. Beckin, and Dr. Lundsdorf and Dr. Horgan,
right.
Just so I don't forget anyone.
Yeah,
there's
good.
A big
I'm
team
looking and- at it. So I was ready because, you know, if you leave Brian Horgan off, I'm going to get a phone call. So just so you know.
So, you know, I really wanted to seek out people that had made some impacts on some of these topics. And we approached it as a, well, let's kind of combine a lot of the information that's been done on some of these different topics. And then not only say, well, here's what's been done, but also put forth some action statements or whatever you want to call it of how can we show some strategies, especially research-based strategies, to decrease our any potential negative impacts, but also then increase the benefits of turf grass. Because there's a lot of benefits of turf grass systems, not sure. Just, you know, not only golf courses, but home lawns and so on, sports fields, you name it. So yeah, we kind of then broke it down into different categories and objectives that hopefully covered almost, you know, most of these areas. So,
well, I would say there's lots of ways. There's always more things you can think of. But this is an excellent start for approaching this with that mindset. If the focus should be on getting the ecosystem services at the highest level, you can get them. And part of that, they have to perform their function, right? It's a golf course. It's got to play good, right? It's a sports field. It's got to be safe. It's a lawn. Many people have a certain view of the lawn. We can argue with that, but that's got to serve that function. But at the same time, it does all these other things that are hidden. As you looked, what surprised you in lead authoring this paper? The kinds of ways you got to look at it now, so much later than when you got your PhD. Like, you came back 11, 12 years after you did your PhD. What were some of the things when you were putting it together were surprising? It's like, man, we're never going to get them to do this. Or, you know what I mean? I mean, like, again, yeah. You talk about reducing things. The first, I'm sure almost every golf course superintendent's thinking, if I reduce that, I'm taking a risk.
Yeah. You know, so much, especially in culture days, there's just these kind of polar ends or the extremism, right? And so I'm not sitting here saying, you know, do the extreme here, but a little goes a long way. And so if you're going to reduce fertilizer a little bit, or maybe be okay with a little bit more insect damage or whatever it may be, you got to communicate that to your clientele, whether it's the golfers on your golf course, or if you're a lawn care practitioner, your clients, or whatever it may be. So we think sometimes that we just need to do the extreme thing and completely do the opposite. And I don't think that's the case. I think there's just some subtle, small changes we can start to make on our management practices or how much water we're applying. And it starts to add up. And then we start to see the benefits of that.
Well, and I see it. You look at this paper, and I would commend this to everybody listening. I believe it's open access. Is it open access?
Yes, it is. Yep.
Yeah, it's open access. And there's a laundry list of topics there. Employ deficit irrigation strategies. Heck, I think Ben Worley from Texas was on my podcast 10 years ago talking about deficit irrigation. And I'm sure Dan Devlin at the University of Nevada 30 years ago was talking about deficit irrigation, right? These are not necessarily any new concepts, right? There really isn't anything here that isn't something that mow less frequently, right?
Yeah.
I think when you say subtle things, I think we've sort of inured the industry into thinking it's 1,100 BMPs. You know what I mean? Because right. that's the facility yep. BMP thing has 1,100 of them. You got to sort of go through and say, do you do? When I know Doug and Michael studied this, right? You know, I had a front row seat to that. They were finding not a lot of the BMPs actually result in reductions, if reductions in emissions is one of our goals, right? So mm-hmm. I'm curious what your thought is about marrying this with the BMPs that we talk about with golf course superintendents.
Some of it lines up, maybe not all of it. But what we wanted to do is when we put together this kind of all these strategies is make sure that we're not just making some statement without any sort of research that backs that up. And so majority of these, pretty much all of them that we compiled together, we cite or from our own experience, you know, there's quantifiable benefits or we can actually, this has been shown, it's been measured to help.
Yeah, just like you found with the fescues. You need this less N and this much less mowing.
You know, and one example of that is my PhD research at K-State. I looked at reducing nitrous oxide emissions. And, you know, nitrous oxide, for those who aren't familiar, it's a greenhouse gas. It's a natural byproduct of denitrification, nitrification in the soil. And we looked at different fertilizer sources and we conducted this on zoysia grass, fairway height, turf. And we looked at different irrigation amounts. But the main thing is we looked at different nitrogen fertilizer sources and we looked at urea and we looked at polymer coated urea. You know, so it's going to be more expensive, but you get that more sustained slow release of nitrogen. And that actually helps to reduce the amount of nitrous oxide being given off in the air, which is a greenhouse gas, which science has shown it has a trapping effect of long wave infrared radiation. And that's why they're called greenhouse gases. It's the same thing as like a greenhouse does. It traps in the glass traps in the heat.
And the nitrogen is what? It's worth 300 carbon units. So you have one nitrogen unit. It's the equivalent of 300 carbon units.
And so something like that, it may cost the golf course superintendent a little bit more money to use a polymer coated urea, but there's multiple benefits. You're going to get a more sustained slow release. You're going to also help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And so you just get more consistent overall better turf quality instead of these peak growths. Right. And then you got to go back in and apply urea again. But you know, urea has its place too. I'm not saying urea is all bad, but right. there's just little ways like that. A, it helps the environment. Also, it's going to help you have more consistent turf quality. That's and you're right. not having peak growths all of a sudden, having to mow it more often.
That's right. So. And of course, when you're talking about golf guys, I'm assuming, you know, a tenth of a pound of urea applied every couple of weeks does not lead to significant nitrous oxide release. I think when you're comparing urea and the polymer coat, you're putting on a slug of N, right?
Yeah, we're putting down a pound of urea in that case. Yep.
Yeah. So it'd be different, right? Would it be different in a smaller amounts of N?
You know, I couldn't say. I don't think we've done any research on. I don't know anybody that's done any research on that. You know, the spoon feeding. That'd be interesting.
All right. So listen, one of the things that I know that you've done exceptionally well. We're not going to chat about it on this talk, but I was looking at your lab page and I was looking at some of your work that you're doing on the scholarship of teaching. So I think that's a great thing that you're doing with the crib sheets and ways of learning and enhancing learning. Big kudos for you to that. But I'm really interested in this Decode 6 thing, decoding carbon and ecosystem services work that you've been doing with the Tri-Societies, I believe. And you've really become our spokesperson, Ross, which is great. I just love that they're recognizing us as a part of the society. We're pretty big, but also something that a lot of people are interested in. They may look down their nose at us a little bit, but the fact is you can't deny the sort of size and scope of what the turf grass industry is, especially in the United States, never mind globally. So how have you liked writing in this? You know, I don't know who the audience is. It certainly has to be scientists like me, but it looks like you're trying to get it to the general public as well.
Yeah, it is. And they approached me. They saw this, you know, the previous scientific journal that we were talking about the strategies reducing inputs and emissions in turf grass systems. And they said, hey, can you talk more about that in this Decode 6 blog or website, whatever you want to call it? Mm-hmm. You're right. And you're thinking the audience is kind of the more general audience, the homeowner, the practitioner. And so taking some of that information and getting it out there, because I think they start to realize like, turf grass industry, it is a big, you know, industry. And when they approached me, I was like, I can't just do this in one article. I need to be able to write this over a couple articles. And I really wanted to, again, talk about ways we can potentially cut back on some inputs. and then why turf grass has its place. It has so many benefits, both economic, but also environmental, societal benefits, psychological benefits, human health benefits. And so I just really wanted to get that across, because I think that's one area in our industry we don't often think about. It's kind of a hidden thing. We don't really think about all this stuff that turf grass is doing, even out just in your home lawn, filtering the water, filtering nutrients, preventing erosion, preventing dust, helping cool the air around your house, among so many other benefits.
Well, because, you know, like I know, we are somewhat to blame for this as an industry because we've industrialized it, right? We've sold a lot of fertilizer, encouraged watering, have tried to get them to do things in a responsible way, right, Ross? But the, the general perceptions of lawns is you should be ashamed, right, if you have a really nice lawn that there's, you know, something wrong, right? Like it's a political statement. You're right. I mean, the sort of polarizing ideas. Now, I can tell you here at, you know, the liberal citadel here at Cornell, I've sort of explored, well, you know, lawns in modern America came about during the suburban boom of Levittown and subsequent booming of suburbia after World War II. And basically, it was only white people who got those loans for those houses, and they redlined and put people of color in a different area. So, you know, I can tell you, we can deconstruct lawns into something that'll make us hate each other if we want to. I wonder if you've gotten any feedback about, wow, huh, I didn't think about that. Or, wow, I don't mind having a couple of this or that in my lawn. Or, yeah, I don't mind if it goes off color during a periodic drought that we're having more now with climate change. Do you hear any of that feedback or commentary when you start opening the conversation up to the broader function that a lawn could have?
No, I haven't really gotten back much on that, but I definitely try to get these some of these points across right away to my students, not just the turf students, but I'm teaching courses that all of our horticulture students at K-State, they're required to take and talk about these benefits and stuff. And I have quite a few students that are kind of anti-turf. and so I hear from them, or, you know, and I'm trying to at least get them to look at it in maybe a different perspective. But again, it kind of comes back to like that extremism thing again, like, you know, like California many years ago were ripping out all their turf lawns and putting in all this synthetic turf. And now it seems like, I haven't read too much into it, but I've seen some stuff. They're like, oh, wait, maybe we shouldn't have
that. Yeah, I think you're right. I think we have to be careful not to run out and make a hyper response where a lot of times the solution was worse than the problem.
Yeah. And I tell my students, I'm like, maybe we don't need 100% turf lawn in the front yard. Maybe we obviously bring in some other landscaping, and it doesn't have to be a complete lawn, and there's nothing wrong with that, but maybe have a little patch of grass so the children can play or whatever it may be. It has its benefits, recreational and getting outdoors, having a green space. But, you know, I get a question a lot too, as far as like bee lawns and stuff. And I haven't done much research in that. They've done some good research up in University of Minnesota and Dr. Bigelow at Purdue University has done some research in that. And I would like to do some more research in that to see and actually quantify, like, if we're incorporating clover or some of these flowering legumes or whatever it may be into the turf, how much of a benefit do they actually have in comparison to, would I be better off having a nice 100% turf lawn and then over on the side I have a nice flower garden? You know, that 10 by 10 patch of flowers probably has way more benefits than a few clover flowers in the lawn. So
listen, Ross, it has been great chatting with you. I really appreciate you taking the time, and congratulations on all the great work that you've been doing before you got to Kansas. And now I know it's really great having you exposed to the students, and it's always good getting a little pushback from the students on some things, isn't it?
Oh yeah, definitely. And thanks again, Frank, for having me on. You, this has been great.
Appreciate you doing it. Thanks a lot. Ross Braun from Kansas State University. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking. Thank you for joining us. Big thanks to Ross Braun. Frankly Speaking, part of the TurfNet family of podcasts, is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, leave us a review. Frankly Speaking is in its 11th season, and we thank our major sponsors, Frostbray Technologies, Dryject Services, and the Plant Food Company, for the support that makes us possible. Take a minute and explore what they have to offer. Frankly Speaking is produced at Rep Studios in downtown Ithaca, New York, by Nate Richardson, with artwork and music by Nicole and Tucker Rossi, support from Peter McCormick, John Kiger, and John Reitman. I'm Frank Rossi. Thank you for joining me.